Welcome to the video podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, where truth and unity matter. Take the deep dive with highly influential voices in and around the 9/11 truth movement.
Welcome everybody back to Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, where we bring you the guests that matter. And there, boy, do we have one today. Captain Raul Angulo of the Seattle Fire Department is coming out. Not in that way. He's making a beef about World Trade Center 7, which has been the wake-up call for so many in the building industry and in the fire industry, especially now with the team of Eric Lawyer for Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, who'll be my next guest coming up next week. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about. The National Fire Protection Association convention, we were all there and we made a stir. I'll introduce him in a moment. First, let's bring on my wonderful assistant my wonderful assistant and guest host.
I'm a guest.
What?
I'm your wife.
My wonderful wife and assistant. You can't forget that part. It's not a secret. I've been married now for 3 years.
3 years. Almost. Yep. Yes, our anniversary is coming
6 years.
Soon.
We don't talk about the first 3 years. We just talk about the marriage part. No, it's all fantastic. And Gail has been an incredible force majeure here at Richard Gage 9/11. She does everything in the background. In fact, Gail, just tell everybody what's going on because she knows it all. let's get it out there. What have we been up to? Where are we going?
Talking to? Well, we did just return from a wonderful speak engagement trip. You already spoke about it a little bit, and it is also the reason our guest is here today. We were at the National Fire Protection Association conference last week. This was in Boston, and it was hosted by the Boston 9/11 amazing people. They put this whole thing together. They funded it. They raised donations to help everybody get there. It was 3 days of amazing connections and sharing 9/11 truth.
So true. It was incredible. And we're going to tell everybody about it because Captain Angulo was there in the flesh. He was the hero of the 3-day major outreach for the 9/11 truth movement, penetrating deep into this key industry for 9/11, the 9/11 truth movement. What else we do?
Well, in about 4 weeks, a little bit less than that, we are on the road again, going to another speaking engagement that all of you are helping us to get to, which is the Red Pill Expo. Richard spoke at the very first one in Bozeman. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that was in 2018 or 17. Anyway, so it's been a few years now, and they've invited him back again, and this time we're in Indiana.
Wait a minute. Now, we also spoke at the Red Pill in Hartford, the Red Pill in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Yes, so, I wasn't going to rattle off all of those.
They seem to want us back again and again and again. What are we going to talk about this time?
Oh, man, you're going to compare the parallels between, I guess I can say it now, COVID and 9/11.
Yeah. Yes. And why can you say it now?
Yes, unfortunately, it's not a good reason, but you guys, we are not streaming from YouTube. Our main channel has been completely taken down, and the Richard Gage 9/11 Again YouTube channel has had, two strikes, so it's very close. And the original
they're calling it hate speech. This was on my technical webinar.
Yes,
so our latest strike was on hate speech. I don't know what I said.
I know.
I think I said we need a new investigation of Building 7. They called it hate speech, got a strike. The whole channel went down, Richard Gage 9/11, and we have one more, but it's got a couple of strikes against it as well, because I simply was telling people what I said that got me in trouble with Spike Lee. I guess I have this desire to tell the truth and I can't stop myself sometimes. That's why I'm unleashed now, by the way, solo, freely flying from AE 911 Truth. Yes. It's a whole story. You can read about it on our website and see my podcast on that subject. RichardGage911.org.
Yes. And talking about podcasts, we had Billy Ray Valentine on Tuesday. So 2 days ago. Great
now,
guest.
Billy Ray Valentine talked more than I did about this horrible situation, the disease that's going around, the false disease and its false solution. I can say things like that and hope to get my channel back or start a new one. Anyway, I interrupted you, Gal. Go ahead.
It's okay.
So anyway, he's not on YouTube for that reason. Well, and other reasons.
Right. And then
but
before
he is on
that,
Rockin, and where else is he?
We have the platforms that we're on are, other than the three Facebook accounts, Twitter and LinkedIn, we are also on Instagram, Rumble, Rockfin, Parler, Odyssey, NewTube, Minds, GabTV, Float, Brighteon, and BitChute. So all of the podcasts and the webinars and all of his Richard's interviews that we that he does will be streaming from all of those. Not live streaming, but they'll be recorded and will be uploaded to those. So, yes, and we are live streaming on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Oh, and also, I always forget the other platform that we used for the 9/11 Pentagon. Do you know which one I'm talking about? Anyways, there is another one that we that's also being live streamed, but I don't know if anybody's actually on it. So, yes, so those are a lot of choices.
You listed all the video platforms, so... the Pentagon conference, which is called 9/11 Con, which you can go to 911con.org and see all of them. They're on one of the several platforms. So you listed them all, did you, or did you not?
No, I'm missing one, and it's right on the tip of my tongue. I forgot to write it down.
Let's add it to the list.
Yes.
Okay.
It's just, yes, I can't think of it. Anyway, so we had Mark Gaffney before Billy Ray. So if you miss those podcasts, make sure you catch them on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, or the other platforms I just listed. And coming up,
Gaffney wrote the book Black 9/11. Encourage you to see that podcast at richardgage911.org. I interrupted you again.
No, it's okay. That's good information. You can expound on the guests. That's wonderful. You do a great job of that. So we have Dave Morgan of the Morgan Report coming up. He's a financial and investment expert. He specializes in economic news and the overall financial health of the global community.
Particularly in the subject of silver and inflation. So stand by for silver to skyrocket, according to Dave Morgan. We'll be asking him questions about that.
Yes. And then the week after that, we have a very special guest who's sort of a partner with our guest today, and that is Eric Laurier. He's a retired Seattle firefighter. I know, we get all excited.
He's my favorite firefighter in the whole world, other than Raul. They're both my favorites.
Yes, yes. And so, and he is also the founder of PAPA, which is the organization that we were at the NFPA conference PAPA. Under that their umbrella, which is Protecting All Protectors Alliance. Yes, he's got a website, too, that you can go and check out.
Which is protectingall.org.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very simple. And then we have Dr. Meryl Nass in July. She's a doctor
who
loves...
Now, she will not be streaming on YouTube.
No.
We will not be streaming her. Why?
Because of what she's going to be talking about.
What's
she's
that?
A doctor. She lost
Just
her license.
Us.
Because
why aren't you telling us what she's going to be talking about? Go ahead.
Am I muted? Richard, you're being real feisty today.
Yeah.
So she was lost her license just because she prescribed ivermectin for her patients that had COVID, which if any of you have done your research, you know that it works wonderfully. It prevents the disease nobody wants, and it helps people recover very quickly if they do have it. So yeah, she lost her license due to that. So she's going to be speaking about this whole medical mess we're in because of this disease.
Well put. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. yes. And we just we're on our webinars. Yesterday we did part two, the Twin Towers explosive destruction, and next Wednesday will be part three, which is the Twin Towers in extreme heat. There, I did it. I've remembered. Yes. So
we next do three week webinars per month. Part one, two, and three. Usually the first three Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific. So you can catch all of these previous webinars at richardgage911.org.
Yes. Yes. And with the, I forgot to mention, with the Red Pill Expo speaking engagement that we're going to be going to in a few weeks, there will be a promo code if you would like to purchase a online virtual ticket to still be able to watch the speakers. There's going to be some great speakers, especially Richard. So we'll have that promo code. We'll be letting everybody know what it is as soon as we get it. And it will also be on the website. And so I just mentioned all of the platforms that we're streaming to and that we upload to, but you can find those also on our website. Just go to the main page, scroll towards the bottom, and there's these buttons for each one. If you click on it, it will take you directly to our Richard Gage 911 account on each one of those platforms. So you can find our videos very easily. And then also, I keep forgetting to mention this, that MP3 files, the audio files of all of our podcasts, webinars, and Richard, I think most of Richard's interviews are also available shortly after each podcast or webinar for you to be able to use if you'd rather use MP3. A lot of people like to listen as they're driving down the road because you're not supposed to be looking at your phone, but you can listen maybe.
Gail adds the link to all of our write-ups in their various places, Substack and our website, in the article. About an hour after today's podcast, for instance, you'll be able to download and listen to the MP3 file.
That's also on Buzzsprout. Buzzsprout.
Tell people about Buzzsprout.
Well, that's the platform where you can go to find, it's Richard Gage 911, and that is where the list of all the MP3s are that you can click on and listen to.
Yeah, all of the audio podcast platforms out there come from Buzzsprout, but you can go to your favorite one, Podbean. Let's get a list of those, Gail, and name those periodically as well.
The ones that Buzzsprout.
Yeah. Also, Gail, we need you to write up the Red Pill Expo with the affiliate code, and because people can, you guys don't have to go to Indianapolis with me, although I'd love to have you. In fact, if you'd like to volunteer at our busy booth, the Red Pill Expo, we always sell out everything we bring. So we get very busy. People ask a lot of questions, and we need your help in Indianapolis, Indiana, on June 8, 9, 10. Yes. July 8, 9, July. 10. But if you can't make it, get on the live stream. So you do that at redpillexpo.org. And soon on our website, we're not ready yet. Gail's got to write up this article. Get our affiliate code in there so you can support us also by watching the live stream or attending the event physically. But we're trying to get free tickets for those of you who can help us at the booth.
Yes.
And what else? We got a guest here today, Gail.
Yes, we do. And we need to get to him. Just want to encourage all of you real quick to please go to our website, richardgage911.org, and sign up for our emails, subscribe and support as, if you're able. And also share with your friends. You can share the link to our website on all of the social media platforms you're on. Share them with your friends, family. Get the word out there about 9/11 truth. It's so critically important. And for the asking the questions for this podcast, to ask the guests the questions, just go to the comment section under each of the videos, the video platform, and put your question in the comment because it pops up on my screen and I'll copy and paste it over so that I can ask your questions of our wonderful guest and you can get those answers.
Yay. And stand by so you can say hi to the captain because he is my guest on Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. He's a former firefighter. In fact, he was the Seattle Fire Department captain at the fire department there. Why is he between a rock and a hard place? Why is he currently challenging the National Fire Protection Association? I spent 3 days with the captain, his favorite Seattle firefighter, also Eric Lawyer, and the Boston 9/11. He's going to say, I don't have favorites, but they get along fabulously. And the Boston 9/11 Truth volunteers who put on the outreach effort, the major outreach effort at the National Fire Protection Association annual convention. And Eric Lawyer represents, and I do too, Protecting All Protectors Alliance. We're going to find out a whole lot more about that alliance because it was key in the whole effort educating the NFPA members. The website, though, is protectingall.org. We set up a WTC evidence booth for the thousands of fire protection professionals, fire marshals, commissioners, chiefs, equipment suppliers for passive and active firefighting systems. Learn more about this incredible 3-day activity from the article that we just posted yesterday, day before. Maybe the day before that. There's a lot of posts going on every day now here at RichardGage911.org. And see the post there at the website, RichardGage911.org. Captain Angulo wrote the book on how to fight fires in structures, including high rises, along with the new NFPA 1700 guide, which we're going to be talking about today. It establishes the standards for fighting fires in buildings. Now, Captain Angulo has sent his own firefighters into burning structures hundreds of times, including some high rises in Seattle. He's never had to worry about the buildings coming down on them until now. He's concerned that the 2008 NIST report on the Solomon Brothers building, World Trade Center 7, we kind of went under the radar at this 3-day conference. So we called it the Solomon Brothers building, which is it's called. Without mentioning WTC 7, without mentioning 9/11. But anyway, this report by NIST presents firefighters quite the problem because for the first time in history, a skyscraper is said to have been brought down by, get this, normal office fires. This has never happened before or since. And the captain says that there have been much hotter, larger, and longer lasting fires in these buildings. So there it is, staring us right in the face. And nobody, virtually nobody, until now, in the industry, is even looking at it. The Solomon Brothers building presents a huge dichotomy for firefighters and for the public, who are told to wait in the burning building for the firefighters who need to get up uncrowded exit stairways to fight the fire. Captain Angulo will present the dilemma to us with all its ugly ramifications to the fire protection industry, to NIST, and to the building industry. Because the structural codes, for instance, in the International Building Code, which I use to design structures to not fall due to fire, and the rest of the architects in the world do the same thing. These standards have not been changed by the NIST report, which came out over 15 years ago. Well, if a building can fall due to a few small scattered fires, then why haven't the International Building Code sections on structural engineering been massively revised? It's like this thing has been swept under the rug, and that concerns my guest. So I want him to tell you straight from the horse's mouth. Captain Raul Angulo, welcome to Richard Gage 911 Unleashed.
Hey, Richard. Gail, thank you for inviting me.
And, Hi, Raul.
Hey, how's it going? I want to start out by thanking the Boston 9/11 volunteers also for inviting me and hosting us over at the NFPA conference in Boston. Jane, Rachel, Chris, Al. So thank you very much. It was a nice opportunity to meet some people in Boston.
Oh, God, was it? They're incredible.
Yeah.
These are the most hardworking, dedicated 9/11 truthers I've ever seen, besides, in addition to the Denver folks, the Minneapolis folks, the San Diego folks, the San Francisco folks, who have had some great events as well. And so many others, people, millions in the 9/11 truth movement care so much. They gather, they meet, they go out, they table, they try to attend conventions where they can get in, like the American Institute of Architects, where when we convened upon with our evidence booth, the national conventions of the American Institute of Architects, we at AE 9/11 Truth, when I was there, attended many of these conventions. Now we're getting active in this way again, and it's producing fruit. Before I ask you about that fruit from this last week, Captain Angulo, let's say goodbye to Gail. Remind people once again how they can ask their questions of the captain when we're done here, so that we can directly address those challenges and support to him.
Yes. So under the video on whichever platform you're watching it on is a comment section. It's either under or, off to the side. Just type in your questions where you would your comments, and they populate up on my screen. I copy them over so that I can ask our guests your questions.
And now that would be Facebook, LinkedIn,
Twitter.
Well, Twitter, do you get questions on Twitter or not?
Yes. Yes, you can ask questions on Twitter. Yes, nobody has.
We're not able to stream right now to the other streaming services, but we're going to fix that soon. Twitch. But I'll load the copy of this up on YouTube. You bet, on Rockfin. You bet, on Rumble. You bet, and the rest of them.
Twitch is the platform I couldn't remember.
We had to leave out Twitch this time.
Oh, okay. Well, never mind.
So now I know what you mean. Yeah.
Okay. So it's that simple. And just please remember, everybody, I'm only saying this because we've had issues in the past. Let's all be adults. Let's all, operate from love.
Be nice, you guys. Yes. And Gail won't ban you, because if she, if she sniffs a sarcastic comment or something like that, she will ban you without warning. Right?
If it's done in a mean way, yes.
But she's done it to me.
If it's obviously sarcastic in a mean way, I will ban you.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Gail. We'll catch up with you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye. There she goes. She'll be back. Don't worry. Captain Angulo, when did you start questioning the official narrative of the destruction of Building 7?
Well, Richard, let me give you a little brief history on how all this came to pass. So, I retired from Seattle in 2016. I finished 38 years on the line. I'm a national instructor and a writer and a speaker. And so if you count the involvement, I've been involved with the fire service now for 42 years. I've written over 300 magazines or 300 articles published in various trade magazines like Fire Engineering and Firehouse. And when you write a magazine article, you can be opinionated, you can be a little more casual. But then I got asked by Jones and Bartlett to write the fourth edition to Engine Company Fireground Operations. And so that was a big project. That book, which came out in 2021, was about a five-year project. And it needed a high-rise chapter. And so I started the research in high-rise. When you're writing a textbook, you got to be really spot on. You can't really be opinionated like you can in a magazine article. And so I read all the other books that were out there on engine company fireground operations, strategy and tactics, and high rise chapters to do my homework. The book got published, and when it went out, you know, you don't have any idea who's reading it or the audience is that it's reaching. My target audience is company officers, senior firefighters. But you know, it goes out to a lot of people, and it went out to you guys. So you called me up, you started asking questions about Building 7, and I knew it had collapsed, but I had accepted the FDNY narrative on that. Your organization and your people brought the videos to my attention, which I hadn't seen, as well as the Alaska study and the real important documentary on calling out Bravo 7. And so the reason why it's important is because I'm writing the companion book, which is Ladder Company Fire Ground Operations. You can't have a textbook on strategy and tactics specifically involving engine companies. And for those who aren't firefighters, the engine company is the pumper truck. That's the one with the hose and water. And their main job is to put water on the fire, deliver water to the fire. The hook and ladder, or the long truck, is called a ladder company or a truck company. Those terms are used interchangeably. But that's the really long 100-foot aerial. That book encompasses all the other responsibilities on the fire ground, search and rescue, putting up ladders, forcible entry, ventilation, salvage, overhaul. So they work together. Well, in prepping for the ladder company book, which I'm almost done, I've finished 15 of 19 chapters. I'm saving the high-rise chapter for last. I had to do more research to really speak specifically about the ladder responsibilities in high-rise fires. So this is when it was brought to my attention to look at the evidence regarding Building 7, the Solomon Brothers building. And the other aspect is I used NIST. There were studies done about 5 years ago for structural firefighting. I don't know if you can see this. This book is was also put out by Jones and Bartlett. And this is called the Evidence-Based Practices for Strategic and Tactical Firefighting. These are experiments, series of experiments that were performed with Underwriters Laboratory, NIST, with the cooperation of the FDNY, New York City Fire Department, Chicago Fire Department, Toledo Fire Department. So there were a lot of fire departments that participated in these live burn on actual structures experiments. And there was a whole variety of information that came out as a result of that, basically relating to modern fuels, which everybody has. It's mainly plastics and new modern construction, not the construction prior to 1950. So when you put those two together, they're fine as long as they're not on fire. When they become on fire, structural collapse can be anticipated in these structures earlier. And the toxic smoke put out by synthetic fuels burns faster, hotter, higher heat release. And so our window of operation to save people gets narrowed. Well, this was I incorporated this into the engine book and kept referring to UL NIST, because these are scientific experiments with scientific data. In other words, I'm trusting the results from these two organizations. And I've been a proponent and a fan of NIST. I always thought their previous work has been pretty spot on. But when it came to the report on Building 7, which I had not read until I met you and a few others that challenged me to read it, I can't really agree with their conclusions on this. As you stated, it also provoked the study from the University of Alaska and the professor, I forget his name, you know him. They came up with their own modeling experiments on Building 7, and they came with the opposite conclusion that NIST did. So I've always looked at NIST as a scientific organization. I'm really relying on this information to be factual and true, because we based our strategy and tactics on frankly, the engineers and the building architects, the fire protection engineers, and people like NIST when they're talking about class one or type one fire-resistive construction, which is high-rise buildings, which is primarily protected steel and concrete, but primarily steel. We're relying on that rating, that's going to give us the greatest margin of safety and operational period in any of the other five classes. That is the strongest building we have in the United States.
And Captain Angulo, that was these are Type 1 protected buildings from the building industry. These cementitious fireproofing that goes on these steel columns and beams is protected to 3 hours protection against fire for 3 hours on the columns and for 2 hours on the beams. Is it your experience that is sufficient? And how long do fires last in any given area?
Well, I always was taught, yeah, I would say it's sufficient. I'm not an engineer, but I'm going to trust your data. But the concept behind it is that any fire load, because you're not going to have exotic fuels in a high-rise building, anything that's exotic like flammable liquids or chemicals, these are under another classification. They're not under type A occupancies in the building code or B occupancies. They're under F or H occupancies. But, you know, residential or business structures, they're not supposed to have exotic fuels or hazardous materials in great quantities. So we're trusting that information is accurate. And yes, the contents for any high rise, the fuel load, which is everything that's on a particular floor, should burn out before there's any structural compromise to those buildings. That's how they're designed to work. They're like a giant incinerator that if we cannot, let's say there's a fire on floor 20, if the fire department cannot make access to floor 20 because it's too hot, too smoky, and other variables, this building is designed to hold all the contents in floor 20 until they burn out. And just the fire triangle, right? It's oxygen, heat, and fuel. Once the fuel is gone, the triangle is broken and the fire goes out. So that's typically what happens if we can't fight it. We just hold on, rescue the people above and below, protect the exposures, which is the surrounding floors, and we wait until the fuel load burns down.
In the case of...
It's really a simple concept.
Huh?
It's a simple concept. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the case of the 2008 NIST report on Building 7, they said that the automatic fire sprinklers in the building were compromised. The flow of water to them was compromised when the towers came down and severed mains. Do you agree with that, or do you have data to counter it, or what?
I do have data to counter it. First of all, there's not a lot of high-rise fires, real true high-rise fires. I mean, if you had a small garbage can fire on the 30th floor, technically you can call it a high-rise fire per se, but because it happened in a high-rise building. But real true-to-life high-rise fires, you know, towering inferno fires, they don't happen that often. And really the examples in the United States, you can count them on one hand. But the best two case studies, and I would say the best case studies to date, because there just haven't been any other fires, is the first interstate fire, which happened in Los Angeles, I think 1986. I don't have that right in front of me, but it was in the early 80s. And the One Meridian Plaza fire in Philadelphia. Those two were the most spectacular high-rise fires that are most notable. It's important to note that the first interstate fire, that building was sprinkled, but the sprinkler system wasn't connected. They were waiting until it was entirely finished to connect the water flow alarm. So technically, you had an unsprinklered building in the first interstate fire. That fire burned up four floors completely, and it never collapsed. In fact, there was no structural damage per se. In other words, the fire load burned up on each floor below there was structural compromise. And that building is in service today in downtown Los Angeles. It's called the Aon Building. It's an insurance company, and you look at it, you would never even know there was a fire there. So technically, that was a non-sprinklered building, or at the time of the event, it was basically a non-sprinklered building because it wasn't connected. If you look at the One Meridian Plaza fire, another spectacular important case study, that building was also not sprinklered. I think that started like on the 20th floor. It burned 10 floors. Now on the 30th floor, it was a private occupant that chose to sprinkler their building independent of the other occupancies in that building. And so when the fire finally reached, they had a whole bunch of problems during this fire. But when the fire actually reached the 30th floor, 10 sprinkler heads put it out.
Mm.
So there was concern on that building that there was going to be structural collapse, and they pulled firefighters out because of that reason, but it never collapsed. Never did.
How many of these buildings, many of which are fully engulfed, how many of them collapsed due to fire?
None of them. There's not a single high-rise building in the United States or Canada that has collapsed. The spectacular ones around the world, San Juan, Puerto Rico, there was one in Madrid, Spain, Thailand, Tehran, even the Grenfell fire, which I mentioned it in my book, that was a spectacular fire. I personally expected structural collapse on that. It never happened. It never happened. Now, there was a fire in Sao Paulo, Brazil. There's been a couple of them, but there was a collapse in Sao Paulo, Brazil in May of 2018. So just over 4 years ago, that building totally collapsed under fire. But the first thing I want to mention to your viewers, if you look at that fire on video, that's spectacular flame. I mean, the whole thing is fully involved. There's flames coming out the roof, on the top floor, on every floor before it finally collapsed. What's important, and I'm going to have you talk on that, that was not really a type one construction building. So even though it did collapse, it's not fair to compare it to regular type one high rise, especially the kind that we find here in the United States.
Yeah, we found that that building was... was primarily a reinforced concrete building. It did have some steel. The steel was not fire protected. It's an experimental building in Brazil, not built according to the International Building Code. Very, very different. And they had squatters in the building because it had gone bankrupt. And so all these people moved into it, set up residences with 2x4 partitions. They used the elevator hoistways for garbage dumps. So they had a huge fuel load in the elevator hoistways, and it was a disaster waiting to happen. But right. None of these other skyscrapers had come down, huh? That's incredible. So what happened then on 9/11 with regard to Building 7, which was not hit by a plane, which had at 5:20 dropped like a rock straight down into its own footprint. Why did you have questions about that?
Well, because, first of all, there was no building left. So whatever NIST did, they did it with modeling, just the way the University of Alaska did it. When I started researching, I actually read the report. And when I compared it to the video, which I had not seen until your organization brought it to my attention, you look at the fire load on the video and the photos of Building 7, and there's a couple of things that are really critical. A, the fire load on that is minimal. I mean, if you look at First Interstate fire, the fire is lapping out the windows. I mean, the fire, it took 90 minutes per floor to anywhere from 45 to 90 minutes per floor. There's two figures on various firefighting what's the right word for that? Involvement. But basically 45 to 90 minutes on the First Interstate from go to floor to floor to floor to floor. And so you have lapping, all the windows failed. There's a tremendous amount of fire on First Interstate. When you look at the fire load in Tower 7, that's basic office furnishings. I would say that's minimal fire. This would be a fire that should be attackable. Or this would be the type of fire that would lead us to say that an offensive interior attack is likely to be successful.
And we learned from from FEMA and others that there was no firefighting efforts in the building. So why would they Why do you imagine? They would have attempted to fight this fire.
They said that there was no water, but I mean, there's video footage of tower ladders and exposure lines operating with full pressure. So, you know, the information that NIST was putting out does not match the video footage that we see. And they're drawing their information from the same media that we're drawing it from. So, you know, I have to be really honest here because I have skin in the game now, Richard, with a book. And they came out with this phenomenon, you know, in their executive decision, there was this phenomenon that fire-induced progressive fires can cause global collapse, global meaning entire collapse. And I just can't, it doesn't pass the sniff test. When you look at the video and the way that building comes straight down, there is no residual resistance on any of the columns. They stated that column 79 on floor 10,
floor 12,
going by memory, floor 12, but column 79, that this was a critical column and it caused an entire building collapse. I don't know how many columns were on each floor, but I imagine 70 over 79, because this is one on each floor. It's not 79 columns throughout the building. I would think it's 79 columns, you know, within the floor. Again, we don't know. How do they know it was 12th floor and column 79? There's no building left. There's no evidence, physical evidence to say that.
Well, NIST was forced to admit in their final report by members of AE 911 Truth that the building came down at free fall for a third of its 7-second fall.
Right.
That just now, doesn't make that sense tells to us me. That you're right, because not one of those columns gave any resistance for that duration. Has fire ever taken out all the columns in the building so it could fall at free fall?
Not in my experience or on any of the research that I've done. When you look at the perimeter edge of Building 7 coming down, it's straight. Now, like I say, this is, you know, puts me in a dilemma because, as you know, anything revolving September 11th is a very visceral, emotional topic for the fire service. And it's difficult for me to even ask questions sometimes. And you know, even being involved with this type of podcast or even going to the conference, there's an element of not fear, but just nervousness on how this will affect my reputation and my work. However, I have to be truthful and I have to defend my work. The NFPA 1700 just came out, and, you know, here it is right here. I picked up a copy of it. Let's see, get that straight. And in chapter 12, section 18, it talks about high-rise fires. There's nothing in there about fire-induced progressive collapses. There's nothing in there that even mentions the conclusion that was in the executive summary of the NIST report. In fact, in NFPA 1700, as well as in every other high-rise chapter or book that's out there, we're primarily still involved with interior operations. And that includes not dumping the building of its occupants, meaning total evacuation. To try and evacuate a building the size of the First Interstate or any of the Twin Towers, I mean, it would take 20 minutes to a half hour. There's just hundreds, if not thousands, of people that can be in a high-rise building. And so on a work day, during work hours. So in addition to that, it's very difficult to control that many people. So when they're coming down the stairs, we're trying to go up the stairs. You know, we're fighting traffic. Some of these stairwells are very narrow, and it's just a nightmare. In fact, most, I would say, all textbooks or chapters on high-rise firefighting, we designate or we try and establish a firefighting stairwell and an evacuation stairwell, meaning we are going to direct people through the PA system to go to an evacuation stairwell, stairwell B, the east stairwell, and stay out of the A stairwell or the north stairwell or whatever, because that's for us. we don't want to be clashing with the public escaping. So there's
are they going to evacuate? Sorry, are they going to evacuate, or are they going to stay in place and wait for the firefighters? Who do you evacuate in the building first, and do you ask the public to wait?
Well, first of all, when you know, and a lot of this is like I still have to do more research, but I know for a fact that if you purchase a condo in a high rise, let's say you live on the 30th floor of a high rise building, or even if you work in a high rise building on floor 30, you have fire wardens on each floor. So just the fact that you're going to be an occupant in a high rise building, they're going to give you a orientation on what happens during fire. And you follow the directions of the fire warden on that floor. So there has to be some organization. In other words, these people are not totally clueless. There are procedures in place that they're expected to follow. And they're trusting that too. So if the procedure for that building is your fire warden will direct you to five floors below the fire floor or 10 floors or eight, whatever the designated floor is, that's where you're expected to go. They're going to tell you to go 10 floors. If it's on 30, they're going to tell you to go to 20. And but they're not going to say, everybody get out of the building right now.
I see.
The problem that we had after September 11th was that people were going to disregard that. They didn't trust that information anymore. So
yeah, I can imagine.
So to this day, we still don't know if that will work 100%. We're still utilizing that. And we call it defend or protect in place, meaning we don't want everybody coming out. Certainly the fire floor, the floor below, maybe two or three floors below, definitely the fire floor, definitely the floor above. And if smoke has contaminated upper stories, we are going to evacuate those people. But we're also maybe going to evacuate them maybe to the 10th floor. We're not going to say go out on the street because there's also hazards on the exterior of the building. You got broken glass falling. Maybe you'll have inclement weather, ice, snow. So, you know, we're relying on the type one fortification to allow us to do operations to fight fire and save lives within the building. It's just the way it's designed.
Makes sense. Well, let's think about the, let's talk about the effort that I would have to say after the Boston 9/11 truth advocates heard about the National Fire Protection Association annual convention in their hometown on their turf, they were not going to stand around and let this opportunity slip by. So how did this opportunity come to you and what was your initial reaction? And then we'll talk about in a minute how what happened there.
Well, I guess I would say, in case there's other fire peers out there, you know, I was invited by the group. They purchased my book. They're asking me questions about things that I wrote and then bringing up the contrary position. So I'm not going to run away from them. I'm not going to fear them and say, I don't want to talk to you or whatever. If I'm writing a textbook, you got to be truthful. I want my information to be truthful and right on. And so I was willing to go as a guest to basically defend my work. I was surprised how many of the people that came by did not. Wait, let me step back 1 second before to fully answer that question. I wasn't there to talk about motives on Building 7 or any of the other ulterior theories. I was there to talk about my experience and my research on the case studies that I'm writing about in the Engine Company book and the upcoming Ladder Company book. And the video of Building 7 doesn't match any of the perspectives that I'm writing about. So that's why I was there. I'm there to talk about the fire behavior or the expected fire behavior in a building such as Building 7. All the motives, everything else, even though it looks like a controlled demolition, which to me that makes sense because that doesn't, that video collapse did not even match the video modeling that was in the NIST report itself. I mean, if you look
at the computer modeling. Yeah.
Yeah. If you look at the computer modeling on the, in their own report, it kind of twists and turns, and it actually looks like this is how it would collapse if it were to collapse. But when you match that NIST modeling video with the actual video, you're looking at two different buildings. It's not the same. So I'm not going to hide behind NIST. I think that their conclusions are more based in political science than they are in physical science. And I have to do that because in the next book, I'm still going to write most of our operations for high-rise fires are interior operations with a strategy to protect people in place. That's the problem I have.
Well, let's take a look at the booth that was set up as a result of the incredible efforts to fundraise up to $10,000 to bring us all to this amazing opportunity to educate the attendees at this conference. We reached hundreds and hundreds of them. Thousands walked by without our opportunity because there were so many that we kept going. But here you are being interviewed by Boston 9/11. And I just want to play a bit of this for our audience so they can get a sense of what actually happened there.
I'm Al Magaletta. I'm here at the NFPA conference. I am a member of the PAPA, Protecting All Protectors Alliance. And I'm here with Raul Angulo and Eric Lawyer.
Can you hear him okay, Raul?
And who are both from originally from Seattle.
Can you hear him okay, Raul?
Raul is a former fire captain of Seattle, and Eric is a former fireman. And I have three questions, two of which are addressed to both of them. And the first question is, why are you here at the NFP conference? And secondly, why do you care about this building collapse? And finally, for Eric, what is PAPA asking for? And I'll start with Raul.
Okay, why am I here? Well, I was invited by PAPA, and I am the author of the recent edition of Engine Company Fireground Operations, fourth edition, which is published by Jones and Bartlett Publishing and in conjunction with NFPA. This is the most recent and comprehensive textbook on strategy and tactics for firefighting and published to date. And there's a high-rise chapter in the book, which caused me to really study the case studies in the United States, as well as some around the world, like the Grenfell fire. And in my research of the case studies, I realized that to date, there's been no structural collapse of any high-rise building as a result of fire. And so the book was published, and then I was contacted by PAPA. They were asking me about, what about the Solomon Brothers building, which is building 7 of the World Trade Center? I was aware that it did collapse. A lot of people don't. They only think that there's two collapses. You know, building, plane, collapse. But there was actually the third building that collapsed later on in the day. And so they turned me onto the website, and I was not familiar with the videos that were available, as well as the NIST study, which I did study and read. And I was not familiar with the study that came out of the University of Alaska. So after going through all that information, you know, I had to yield to their concerns and basically agree. My consensus is that I don't agree that Building 7 collapsed as a result of fire. I realized that NIST did their speculation on modeling. There was no real hard evidence. It was all theorized, which makes the University of Alaska study so important because they didn't agree with it and they did their own modeling and came up with a different conclusion that this was not as a result of a, of a single column collapse. So why is that important? It's important because in my new book, in the high-rise chapter, we haven't changed our high-rise strategy and tactics for the last 20 years since September 11th. We're still setting up the command posts, usually in the lobby or at the fire control center of a building. We're using that control center because we're relying on the building features to help us control fire, whether it's through the sprinkler system, the ventilation systems, the HVAC systems. We're relying on the building to help us fight the fire. We're still setting up staging two floors below the fire floor. We're not evacuating entire buildings of their occupants. We're using the type one construction safety ratings to execute our ability to protect people in place. For example, we may move them five floors below the fire floor. Certainly, we're going to remove people above the fire floor, floor above, maybe two floors above, wherever there's smoke contamination. We're going to move them to a safer place. But our initial strategy is not to dump the building. And so these are still the current best practices for high-rise firefighting. So when you look at the NIST conclusion, which was based on the fire load of office fire load, that you can have a phenomenon that can collapse a single column and dump an entire building and collapse it, I'm sorry, I just can't buy it. And the problem that I have with NIST is I'm relying on them, because in my book, I'm using the NIST UL studies and relying on the integrity and accuracy of the NIST experiments for residential construction in relation to modern fuels and lightweight truss construction to cause us, and for me to write the book, to modify our strategy and tactics for residential fires using the evidence that was and recommendations that was provided by NIST. So unfortunately, I can't accept their recommendations or their conclusion on Building 7. It just doesn't compute. So,
well, that's pretty enlightening. Do you have any other thoughts about all of that? I mean, you've really kind of staked a claim here. Are you concerned?
Well, Kevin? I am in the sense, I wanted to bring up three more things, Richard. In my book, there was a fire in San Francisco. It was the Gateway Tower fire. I think it happened in, I have skin in the game because I am.
Sorry.
I think it happened in 2020. There was also one in Los Angeles. I can't remember the name of that one. These were residential high-rise fires, but substantial high-rise fires. There was also one that I talk about in my class that I teach at the Fire Department Instructors Conference, and that was the Marco Polo fire in Honolulu, Hawaii. I think they lost like, I can't remember now if it's three or nine people. I think they lost three people, nine floors. But these were all interior high-rise firefighting, and all of those were offensive attacks, meaning the firefighters went in, they're fighting the fires on the floor. They're relying on the type one construction. And these are the most recent examples. If you had a high-rise fire today, we would be inside the building operating with our normal best practice procedures on how we fight fire. We're not going to be going, oh my gosh, this building's on fire, it's going to collapse. There's no mention of any fire phenomenon in the 1700 NFPA guide for structural firefighting. They should have at least mentioned that. There's no mention of it. Mm. There's no mention at all that we should even be cautious on structural collapse in high-rise buildings that are on fire. In Chapter 12, which includes the high-rise, they even talk about high-rise hospitals. All right, now we're talking hospitals. And in the 1700 standard, they're talking about protecting in place. So, So they have a, I think that they have to revisit this issue. And really, it's not us against NIST. I really think the core of the issue is going to have to be NFPA against NIST. They're either going to have to change the standards and the recommendations to include what NIST was recommending and identifying as a phenomenon, or they're going to have to put some sort of disclaimer that the NIST report on Building 7 is not accurate. That's probably the nicest word. And it's not that we're picking on NIST. Again, you have to realize that there's not that many case studies. So on any given day, if a building would have collapsed like this, this would have been the case study in my whole career.
Yeah.
It would have been the case study to study. There would have been presentations at the national conference. I mean, we would have been saturated with information on how the Solomon Brothers building collapsed. There's been nothing on it. Nothing.
Well, let's see.
Even at the NFPA convention, which there were a lot of people from the fire service, even from around the world, they never knew there was a third collapse on that date. So that was amazing to me. I would say like maybe what, 90% of the people that we saw did not know, 80 to 90%. There were some that did, but
it was shocking.
There was a third building collapse.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really important is that that building collapse happened like at after 5 p.m. in the afternoon. The towers were attacked at 9 o'clock. NIST is stating that when Tower 1 collapsed, that it was the debris that, that blew out from the collapse of Tower 1 that caused the spontaneous ignition of 10 floors on Building 7. That just doesn't make sense to me. I'll ask the audience two important questions. Well, one statement, but one question. The question is, when you look at Tower 1 and 2 collapse, and they were very similar, you see this big cloud of dust, just this gray mushroom, all right? Other than the initial moment when the planes hit the tower, you have this big old fireball and you have fire. And there's a little bit of fire once they start to collapse. But once they're collapsing, it's just this thick cloud of dust. And then it hits the ground and you got this monumental cloud. All right, compare that to the Sao Paulo video in May of 2018. You can see it online. Even though we said this is not a type one structure, look at that building when it collapses. When it starts to collapse, and it was total or global, as they use that term now. I hadn't heard of that prior to this event. But when you look at the Sao Paulo and it collapses in that dust cloud, there's tons of flames everywhere. It's a fireball collapse, not just a dust collapse. So there's nothing like that on Tower 1. Plus, World Trade Center 5 and 6 are standing between Tower 1 and Tower 7. So in other words, you have two big-ass buildings that are taking and absorbing a lot of the energy from the collapse before it reaches 7. Okay, now I did see video of Tower 5, and I was actually there when it was still smoldering. So I saw it with my own eyes. That building was burned to a shell. If you look at 5, everything burned on 5, and it never collapsed.
Mm.
So it looks like it just looks like the steel structure. It's just taken down to the steel beams, cross beams, and pillars, but it never collapsed. And there was substantial fire load on Building 5 when you look at it. So you compare that fire load to the fire that's burning on 7, and then you're going to tell me that that was sufficient to collapse a single column 5-6 hours after impact. You know, office furnishings are going to burn and burn out within 45 to 90 minutes. That's what happened in the first interstate fire.
Is that what you're talking to these people about? And who are these people?
There was a lot of retired fire chiefs, fire marshals, a lot of fire protection engineers and a lot of engineers. And yeah, these were the things that I were talking about. Now, there's a lot of theories behind the attacks. I get that. And I don't want to go there. Me personally, I'm just isolating my comments to how this building should have responded with that type of fire intensity, which I would say of all the high-rise fires that we have in our case studies, Building 7 had the least amount of fire. Mm-hmm. So, and it had the least amount of fire and the worst catastrophic result. Come on. You know, you don't have to be a scientist to connect those dots and say, well, that just doesn't pass the sniff test. And then the way the building collapsed straight down, if you look at the perimeter, that's a straight line. That is You know what? I've seen a lot of building collapses. I've seen partial structure collapses. They never collapse like that, right? The only type of building that collapses like that is what? You tell me, right? And there would have the it's important that the University of Alaska study stated that the only way for that type of collapse to happen was the simultaneous removal of all the columns at a lower level to collapse a building like the video shows in 7 at free fall. Okay, well, there's only one way you do that. You can say it, not me, but I am going to say it wasn't as a result of that fire. Not that what we see, the intensity in the video footage. Sorry, I'm not going to subscribe to that.
Well, who are all of these people? You mentioned fire commissioners, fire marshals, chiefs. What did they have to say about this dichotomy? You're presenting them a black and white scenario. On the top of our booth, we have Building 7 coming down second by second there. And on the video, that stops people in their tracks. If they don't see it, I stop them and I say, look, I design buildings not to do this. And they laugh right. And they listen. And then they ask a few questions, I introduce them to you or Eric Lawyer standing right behind you there. And you talk to them. Now, how do those conversations go? What's the response?
Okay, well, again, I got to be
a range of responses.
I got to be really cautious here because, you know, I have to think about my peers. And like I said, it's a very visceral, emotional subject. The reason why I want to talk about it is because, A, there were no firefighters that lost their life in Building 7. There were no civilian fatalities, even though there's some information to the contrary. The NIST report states there were no civilian fatalities. The building was completely evacuated. And 3, it wasn't hit by a plane. All right. So just going on those 3 premises alone, the fire service has to look at this building and go, okay, well, what caused it to collapse? We have to have some sort of acknowledgement one way or the other. Just try and remove the emotional narrative from September 11th and just isolate on the building. Like I said, I don't want to talk about motives and the conspiracies and this and that. There's plenty of people that do that. I'm just coming at it from a tactician and an author of, you know, there's going to be 2 books on how we fight fire, high-rise fires. So from that position alone, we need to it's time to critically look at the factors that tumbled this building in complete free fall, total global collapse. And any fire service professional that I know, and some of these people were there, came to the same conclusion. It didn't happen the way NIST said it did. So there we go. There were people that said, well, it looks like a controlled demolition to me. And I would tend to agree because we've seen plenty of those. All you got to do is watch the movie Casino. If you've seen the movie Casino with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci, right? We've all seen that. That building ends. The storyline is the mob lost control of Vegas and the corporates came in and they built the new buildings and casinos that we see today. So the old high-rise buildings, they have a whole little vignette of all these collapsed buildings in Las Vegas. So just look at that. And they all look eerily similar to the way the Solomon Brothers building came down. So that was the conclusion many of them were drawing with the nod of a head, with the look. Nobody really wanted to say it because I think they're as cautious as I am. The alternative or the narrative on why it happened, if it truly was a controlled demolition, is too difficult for us to face. It's very difficult to think that there would be some other motive than an accidental cause of fire that would cause this type of collapse. But again, no firefighters were injured in this fire. So let's talk about it.
Now, when I think you too, when we talk to these people. We present the dilemma. So they're kind of hooked. We don't yes. take them down the rabbit hole of controlled demolition. In fact, we avoid the entire discussion of 9/11 by referring simply to this building as the Solomon Brothers building. And some of them will ask, well, when did that happen? Well, we said, well, this happened in September of 2001. You know, just trying to avoid the rabbit hole, because once people realize that this is the third tower on 9/11, all of a sudden they think they can't challenge it anymore because it's sacred territory, right. or the fear of having to be responsible for some other cause other than fire imposes a responsibility on us to actually change our worldview as we step deeper into this. Have you changed your worldview at all?
I have. And really, it's not because of September 11th. Okay. I changed my worldview based on other recent historical events. When you look at the information that came out on the pandemic, when you came, the vaccine was supposed to eradicate COVID-19. The reason why this is important is because, for example, during the first 18 months of the pandemic, cities like Los Angeles and specifically Seattle, the guys were working in the trenches. Then came the vaccine mandate. You had to get vaccinated or you couldn't be a firefighter anymore. Mm. I know for a fact that Seattle fired many firefighters. A lot of them were forced to retire early. I don't have the exact number, but it's close to 100. But very close friends of mine were fired from the Seattle Fire Department because they would not take the vaccine, the COVID vaccine. Right?
Wow.
All right. And it also happened in Los Angeles and in some other cities, including New York. Including New York, they were fired because of the vaccine. Well, I was just reading yesterday that Dr. Fauci got COVID, right? So now Dr. Fauci, who's probably been vaccinated 120 times with I don't know how many boosters, and he's wearing 3 to 5 masks.
Probably not.
Now he has COVID vaccine. I mean, now he has COVID. So bottom line is the vaccine doesn't work. There were firefighters in Seattle getting COVID after the mandate and after these guys were fired, meaning everybody who was still there in January, February of this year had technically been vaccinated and they're still getting COVID. So conclusion can you draw that the narrative isn't correct? So let's go with that. Let's go with how the United States exited Afghanistan. You talk about the Hunter Biden laptop that didn't exist. Now it does. The Russia collusion and all that with President Trump and now Ukraine. Who knows what's going on? The point is that we have to look at where we're getting our information from and who's giving our information. And it always comes from the mainstream media or the regular outlets. And they tell us one thing and then another. So really, that's what started questioning me on the whole. It wasn't so much September 11th. It's just that you're looking at things around you and you're going, this just isn't normal anymore, Richard. And I came to the conclusion that, no, I'm not going to agree with everything my government says or that this is the way it happened. And unfortunately, or fortunately, NIST is part of the Department of Commerce, right? And they're a government agency. They're not a scientific independent organization. They're part of the U.S. government. So it's all these things in conjunction that you're looking around and going, well, you know what? This is not how I see reality anymore. And it made it easier now, 20 years later, to start asking the tough question. But I really don't want to go there. That's going to light up a whole that's a whole nother rabbit hole, but that helped really put me in the perspective to pay attention and look at this information with a critical eye. Because I got to tell you, Richard, before I couldn't hear it.
You couldn't hear it at all.
I didn't want to accept the. I had personal friends that were from the New York City Fire Department that were there. And so I didn't really pay attention to the other information because I had firsthand report. So that's all I needed for years and years and years. So,
wow. But
now I'm at a point, especially being an author of a textbook, I have to look and go with what feels good in my gut. And I'm relying on the truth And for any of the organizations that contribute information, there has to be veracity in their information, has to be reliable, and most important, has to be unbiased and truthful. It's all about trust. If I can't trust where I'm getting my information on the sources that I'm writing a textbook giving instruction to firefighters who are risking their lives and that their civilian lives at risk, then I'm not going to use that information. I'm certainly going to investigate it and track it down. But if I'm writing a book to save lives, it's got to be based on truthful information, because most of all, my audience and me as an author, they have to trust what I'm saying is true. And that's the bottom line right there.
Gotcha. So you came as a guest to NFPA, the convention, a guest of Protecting All Protectors Alliance. Now, let's talk about this organization and what its purpose is and how well did it succeed or not in the in the effort in Boston. Let me bring up that website. Here it is. This is the website here. And this was founded by firefighter Eric Lawyer, formerly of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. Now, was it Eric that came to you and invited you to be a guest at the booth of this organization? And what can you tell us about the organization?
Yeah, Eric invited me. Eric was the first one who challenged me on the 9/11 narratives way back in, it was after 2002. I can't remember when he first got involved in it, but I couldn't hear Eric. I thought he was I thought he was off base. I thought he was a wingnut wackadoodle. You know, he was just, couldn't hear him. And I felt bad because he's going to isolate himself, and he did. But after I wrote the book, all right, there's a difference between writing an article and writing a textbook. Now I had way more knowledge than I did when I first talked to Eric. And, I had to really listen carefully. In fact, I called him up and apologized for writing him off so quickly. Here's what's interesting. Like, I've been to a lot of these conferences for firefighter training. And I know that booths on the perimeter of a convention floor get the least amount of traffic. You know, people pay premium dollars to have a booth on the main aisleways. And we were on the second to the last row, or pretty much the last row. But we always had a crowd. You know, the videos and having two screens showing that loop of the collapse was very effective. I mean, it stopped people in their tracks. If you look at the surrounding booths that were next to us, the vendors had not nearly close, they didn't even come close to the traffic we had.
And most of us were busy at all times.
Exactly. It was all day long. The flow was, even on the last day, which by the last day, people have already walked the floor. They're done. They've been there, seen it. They move on. In fact, it's been my experience at a lot of conventions, even like the FDIC, that last day, the vendors start closing up because traffic's so slow. I mean, we had traffic until 3 o'clock on the last day. That is very unusual. Yeah. It's very unusual. And I also noticed that I didn't personally run into anybody who was hostile or negative to the information that we were giving them. Again, I think now 20 years later, people are seeing things differently. I don't know if this would have been as successful in 2002, 2005, but you know, it's 20 years old. And so I think people are willing to listen now. I think that there's a new generation out there that find this particularly interesting.
Well, we did collect about, 300 sets of data from all the people that stopped by who, you know, held out their badge for Gail and the rest of us to scan. And we have those emails, and we're going to be following up with them. We're going to be.
Well, it was because it was Gail, not you.
Yeah. Well, she's prettier than I am, but I got a few of them, and she and I and the rest of us are just delighted with the results here. But this email follow-up, which will be this week, we will be in thanking them for stopping by the booth, reminding them that there's this dilemma between NIST and FEMA, reminding them
NIST,
that
NIST and NFPA.
I said FEMA. I keep saying FEMA.
I know. Don't say FEMA.
FEMA and NIST
it's
roll
important
off.
To get these right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the NIST says the building came down by office fires. And right. NFPA says go into burning buildings. And you particularly with your textbook right there in front of you, this is the rock and the hard place that,
really, this is the rock and the hard place right uh-huh. here. There we go. Get it balanced. 1700 is the rock and the hard place now.
Because it sends fire. It's official NFPA
it's
document.
Standard. Exactly. It's the standard. Now, and they don't mention anything about it. So you would think that if even the potential of a collapse with that amount of fire was a possibility, it would be in the standards. They got all the other safety warnings in there, and there's nothing on this one. So I do plan on sending that to the committee because I know they're going to be taking input to update 1700, and that needs to be in there. They're going to have, they can't sit on the fence on this one, Richard. I think they have to go either one way or the other.
Right. But, and you've talked to some NFPA officials. Can you tell us about those conversations?
I did. It didn't have anything to do with this particular subject, but what we talked about was the importance of 1700 and just the importance of standards. And so I think NFPA is going to be in a position that I was in. They're going to have to defend their work. They're going to have to defend their work because people are going to start asking questions. And it's just time now. So, and like I said, there were, you know, it's really important getting 300 names with a type of conference like NFPA, which you, if you compare that to the Fire Department Instructors Conference International, FDIC International, that's the largest training conference in the United States. I mean, with everyone, their total attendance, just before the lockdown, it was over 30,000. All right. I think this year, coming back online again, it was around 27,000. So that's a good showing. That was nowhere near the size of the NFPA conference. The NFPA is a substantially smaller conference. But to get 300 signatures like that, to get the amount of traffic and people hanging around, that was a visual for other people to go, well, what's going on there? And so it was really good. The other thing I thought is a key factor was first your tenacity. I mean, you were really in the mid like an angler, but you're an architect. So you're designing the buildings that the firefighters are going to be working in. And then your wife, Gail, she has two sons who are firefighters. So as a mother, she also has a concern that this information, actually she has a concern that the information I'm putting out as an author of a textbook is going to be accurate and truthful. And you're putting your name on plans, architectural design. You want that information to be factual and truthful. And it's a collaboration of all the organizations from fire protection engineers to the system engineers to UL and all these people and NFPA, the building code, the International Fire Code, International Building Code, the Electrical Code. All these things come together when a building is being built. And for firefighters, they don't have to be experts on any one of these subjects. It's an issue of trust that the information is going to be received by the chief officers and the senior fire officers, and they're going to trust the information so that they can go inside and fight these fires with the greatest window of success. So it's an issue of trust. They don't have to be engineers. Because I'll tell you what, the engineers and the architects and the fire protection, they're not going into the building when it's on fire. They're not going in. They don't have any skin in the game during the emergency.
Yeah.
Only the people who live there and the firefighters who are have to go in to put the fire out and rescue them. Those
now, Papa, the Protecting All Protectors Alliance, this is the video on their website, which is highlights the data that should be of alarming concern to firefighters and the NFPA. The video we're watching is the trailer to calling out Bravo 7. And in the firefighting industry, Bravo 7 means?
It means B7.
Building 7.
Building 7.
So I think he was trying to be of code. This is Paul Cayley of the UK. Incredible film, which highlights the history of fires and the contradiction between them not coming down steel frame fire protected buildings like this one, the first interstate
there. Look at the volume on that one right there. That's First Interstate. That's also First Interstate.
Did it collapse?
The whole floor is on fire. This is the First Interstate after, and this is the First Interstate as it exists now as the Aon building.
And in Venezuela, we have this building, which didn't collapse.
Yeah.
So you don't worry about going into buildings like this, even when they're full.
Well, I always worry about buildings. And you said something in the beginning. We're definitely worried about structural collapse on residential structures. But the one that we have the most confidence in are high-rise buildings. And again, that people can point to the Sao Paulo, Brazil in May of 2018. But that's not a fair comparison because it was substandard high-rise construction. So exclude that one. Other than looking at how much fire was in the actual collapse, I don't know if they're but there's Building 7 right there. Look at that. That's nothing.
Well, that's actually a great shot.
There, if anyone who's doing the size up, that looks like that is totally within the spectrum of initiating an interior attack.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I'm not saying it's not going to be hot. I'm just saying that looks like it's, you would probably attack it. And as they show other, if you look at towards the left of the flames, okay, and NIST talks about that, you don't see any more fire or you see less fire. Why? Well, that's because the fuel is already burned up, just like a campfire. If you leave the campfire alone, it's just going to die down. You got to put another log and stoke it, right? We're all familiar with that. The reason the campfire goes out is there's a break in the fire triangle, either heat, oxygen, or fuel. And if you got good air and your log burns out, fire's going to go down because there's nothing left to burn. So it's really simple. We've learned about the fire triangle since we were in grade school. And it is what it is because it's physical science. It's science, not political science.
Political science. I love that analogy or reference. So on the PAPA website, we refer, this will be the key and was the key website that the card that we handed out. We handed out over 500 cards you know, some people didn't want to give us their email, but we refer all of them to this website, which highlights calling out Bravo 7, highlights the video 7 made by Dylan Avery for AE 9/11 Truth, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Excellent film, talking about the finite element analysis by one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country, Professor Leroy Halsey, who took on the task that Congress had authorized NIST to do, but NIST failed miserably, as you began to point out there. This completely pulls the rug, this study, out from underneath the NIST report, and quite incredible. And this 30-page paper, Sudden Building Collapse, an Evaluation of a New Risk in Operational Firefighting, excellent job, an independent analysis of this building's collapse by Paul Cayley. That's on the website. The official, the final report by the Alaska study, Leroy Halsey, is on here too. And there's witnesses of explosions on the PAPA website, so people can get a sense that no, it wasn't fire. There are hundreds of witnesses. Well, in Building 7, there's almost a dozen witnesses of explosions. So we have the beginnings of a very, very good website, which will be continually populated here for those whom we're going to follow up with from the conference.
I would just say this, Richard. I think probably the most compelling thing for me was actually watching the 2020 edition of Calling Out Bravo 7. That is the most comprehensive collection of information that the average civilian can draw their own conclusions. And you don't have to be a scientist. It's not that scientific. It's common sense. But that really was the linchpin for me to give up my previous perspective on previous narratives, I guess. And it actually gave me the, for lack of a better word, courage to go forward with this.
Well, I'm so glad to hear that.
The last chapter I'm writing for the latter book is going to be Ladder Operations and High-Rise Fires. And so I'm still researching high-rise fires, and I can't come to any other conclusion, but it's not the NIST conclusion. I'm sorry. That's really all there is to say.
All right. Well, let's see if we have some questions for you from Gail. She's typically quite good at collecting the questions out there. Gail, what do you think? What's going on out there
in the
social media world?
I do have some questions for
Ron. I told you.
All right. Scroll up. Are you ready, Raul?
I am.
He looks ready. They're trained to be ready at a moment's notice.
Okay. Well, Paul, I just wanted to share this. Paul Cayley says, hi to Raul from firefighter Paul Cayley in the UK. Great work, Raul. Right behind you from the Atlantic.
Oh, that's the author really of the 30-page paper and the maker of the film Bravo 7. Thanks, Paul. Great to have you aboard.
And then he says this, Paul does, as a firefighter, I contacted the IAFF, the International Association of Firefighters, an organization responsible for protecting the safety and working conditions of American firefighters, to find out what investigation they have done regarding the cause of the collapse of WTC-7 and its implications for fire and firefighting procedures. They have not looked at it. You have to ask why. So I thought that was really awesome that he reached out like that.
That's right. And they have done investigations in the past. And I have been not a part of it as a participant, but we had a fatality fire in Seattle where we lost 6 guys. And the International Association of Firefighters, which is the union, which I was a member of the whole time I was a Seattle firefighter, they also did inquiries and investigations on the Mary Pang fire. So, yeah, as far as I know, nothing's been done on this one. And then partly because there were no firefighters' lives that were lost in Building 7. And that's probably the reason why, because the IAFF doesn't do reports on buildings that collapse anywhere else. If there's no fatality involved, they're probably not going to take it on. So that's probably one reason.
Ah, good point.
Gotcha. Yeah. This question is from Ray. He says, question for Raul, is jet fuel considered an explosive or is jet fuel a flammable liquid? What is the difference in blast pressure between the burning of jet fuel and the use of explosives? Could it
go ahead. Is there still more to it?
Just a little bit. Could it be that explosives were on board the planes that hit the towers? So is jet fuel considered an explosive or is jet fuel a flammable liquid?
Jet fuel is a flammable liquid. And I can't answer the second half of the question, only to say that an explosion, and I have the definition in my book, but an explosion is kind of defined as a very, very rapid combustion process. You have slow combustion, fast combustion. And so the rapid combustion of a fuel would be considered an explosion.
Okay.
But no, jet fuel is not an explosive commodity. It's a flammable liquid. And then, as far as the other technical stuff on that one, I'd have to look it up. I don't have it on the top of my head. Yeah.
All right. KL asks, isn't it true Congress doesn't have to vaccinate?
Well, let's go on to the next question.
Okay.
That would be a little more appropriate.
Yeah, that's just more of a statement than a question. Miles,
and I don't know if it's true or not, but it's just not the subject of our inquiry today.
All right. Miles says, yes, is Captain Angulo available to potentially visit Canada to share this information up here? He's in Canada. I would volunteer to assist in any way that I can from Calgary.
Well, Miles has noted that Miles has noted that the Canadian firefighting associations are meeting. He even gave us the city in a response to in our webinar yesterday. But if we can arrange another booth in Canada of equal size audience, would you be willing to fly to Canada or anywhere else in the U.S. For that matter?
I have to think on that because again, it's still a balancing act, Richard. And I have a future publication coming out, so I got to be really careful because there's obviously political forces involved at this level for sure. We're not naive. And I have to keep my discussions strictly around fire behavior in buildings, and then I think I'm okay. So to the question of Canada, it would depend on the venue, who's the audience, what's the purpose. I would ask those questions before I would agree to say, oh yeah, let's do it. You know, what's the end game here? What are we looking at? And what's the purpose of the visit? But I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to it. So it has to be in the confines of fire behavior in high-rise buildings. And then I think I can go forward on that. Is cool. That good enough of
awesome.
An answer?
That is. Yes. All right. This question is from Ray. You mentioned the dust clouds when the towers came down, and you mentioned that there was a fireball when the planes crashed. Did you ever look into the dust clouds that were ejected out of the towers when the planes crashed? What was in these dust clouds that can be seen right after the planes crashing? It's a lot of questions. What did NIST say about these dust clouds?
It's like I said at the beginning, I'm not really going to comment on Tower 1 and 2 because the wild card on that as far as fire and building behavior is that they were struck by airliners, and no building, I don't care how strong it is really designed to take that type of a lateral impact like a karate chop. You know, they're relying on gravity and vertical forces to stabilize the building. There was a plane, I think it was a B-29 or a smaller B-something aircraft, I have to go look at it, that hit the Empire State Building during the 40s. You're aware of that, right, Richard?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it was a smaller plane. It wasn't like a big-ass bomber or anything. But, you know, the Empire State Building, that's a fortress. And, you know, it was built with the technology of the time. To build a similar building would be so cost prohibitive. We're just not going to see buildings like that anymore. But that absorbed the impact of a plane. And but again, that's not your regular type one construction. So all I'm just saying on the buildings with Tower 1 and 2 is that we've all seen when the planes hit, you did see the big fireball, and that makes sense. That big fireball is going to be the sudden release of the jet fuel when the tanks are compromised. And that fuel is going to be consumed rather quickly. It's not going to burn for hours and hours and hours, just like gasoline. You light, throw gasoline in a pit or on the sidewalk, light it off. It'll burn really intense and then it'll die down very quickly. But the point I was making with the dust clouds is that NIST is saying that it was that lateral, blowout from the buildings that ignited 10 floors simultaneously on building 7, bypassing building 5 and 6. I'm just saying it just doesn't sound probable to me.
And 5 and 6 were...
5 and 6 were between Tower 1.
They were almost completely destroyed. They weren't bypassed altogether.
And I'm not. And you know what? Again, I'm not an expert on all this. You can ask the question. Well, what caused the ignition in Building 5? Okay, I don't have an answer for that. But the further away you are, the less likely you're going to have this. Sudden ignition, all right? And I think you'd have to look and follow the sequence of Building 5 in order to get what were actually the ignition factors of that, which I don't know.
What we demonstrate in our webinar series, 9/11, An Architect's Guide, in Part 2 and 3, which are on the Twin Towers, particularly Part 3, the incendiary chemical reactions involved in the towers, is that we have incredible heat, 3,000 degrees, which cannot be accomplished by jet fuel or office fires. All kinds of evidence everywhere for those kinds of temperatures. Massive explosions heard by hundreds of witnesses. And so I'm just telling our audience that this information is indeed covered, including the expulsion of 4 and 8-ton structural steel sections weighing expelled 80 miles an hour laterally out of both towers, trailed by thick white smoke clouds. So these are massive structural steel members that are trailing thick white smoke clouds, indicating that the ends of them are on fire. Well, as you know, Captain Angulo's steel members do not catch fire in normal office fires. So what caught the ends of these steel beams on fire? And this is, of course, the most likely cause of the fires in Building 7, because these beams did impact 7.
And that's for you guys to discuss. Like I said, I'm not going to really, you know, beyond just the observation of the collapse cloud. But again, going back to Building 7, all right, when you're looking at Building 7, the video footage of that, those windows are broken out, but the structure looks, it doesn't look impacted. You know, there's not big divots in there. There's not chunks of the building missing. It looks like it's all intact. I mean, it's symmetrical, right? It's a rectangle. Everything looks like, it doesn't look like it was impacted by, you know, strong structural forces. So that's all I'm going to say. Just look at what you see. As a fire officer, I would have to do a size up, and part of my size up is to look at the building and make decisions on the structural stability and the fire involvement before I send people in. And for Building 7, it looks like the structure looks totally within the rating of a Type 1 building, and that fire would look like I would lean towards an offensive interior attack. So that's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Gail, let's jump to Kale's question.
Okay. Kale asks, were you still active duty firefighter when you started speaking out? If so, was your career employment threatened for speaking out, and or do you know other firefighters that are not allowed to speak out?
I was not employed anymore. I was already retired, which is one reason why I would never do this if I was still employed. I probably would just avoid it.
Listen to that statement. I'm going to repeat it. I would never do this if I were still employed as a firefighter. Why, Captain?
Because I can't calculate or forecast the pushback. It's just like a whistleblower. The whistleblower laws sound good on paper. I've never been a whistleblower, but I have seen people that have blown the whistle, even within my own organization, and it didn't turn out well for them. They didn't have the protection that was implied when you read the whistleblower policies or laws. Mm-hmm. So you run the risk. It's just life. You know, it's just the way people are. And you have to understand there's, in any organization that involves city government, civil government, there's politics involved. And so it's just the reality of it. There's politics involved in everything. So the so I'm retired. The only real risk liability is my reputation and my work, which I'm concerned about. But I think if I am following the truth, then I'm okay. I would think that people have questions, and if people don't answer them within the industry, they see that there's fear there. Like, why can't I get the answer to the question? So I'm not afraid to ask the questions, and I want to answer truthfully and draw conclusions, because really that's where my credibility and expertise and integrity comes in, as being an author of fire service publications, articles, and textbooks. So I really don't have a choice but to be truthful and follow the truth.
Great. And the FDNY, of course, are perhaps the most traumatized. They lost 343 of their own. There are very few of them that have been speaking out. Do you believe that the reason they're not speaking out is because of their employment? And for those that are retired, they have pensions, right? Is that an issue too?
Yeah, it is. And you're just going to play it safe. It's just the way it is, Richard. I think there's a tremendous pressure to not go against the narrative of the organization. And that's just a reality. And the other thing is, what's the alternative? The alternative is almost too hard to swallow, that somehow there was nefarious motive behind this. There were other motives behind this. To think that our government would deliberately jeopardize firefighter lives, they can't go there. It's hard for me to go there. So,
yeah, it's extremely difficult. But we have a final question.
The alternative is just too hard to realize. In fact, it's interesting that I was talking to this one retired firefighter at the conference, and he said, well, you're not going to convince me that what I'm looking at here was a detonation, that this was actually that Building 7 came down. You're not going to convince me of that. Okay. But I said, fine, I'm not going to try it. But I am going to tell you that building didn't come down as a result of the fire that you're looking at. I'm sorry, I don't believe that. And his answer was, it's too hard for me to think of the alternative.
Oh,
which he was saying was, if it was a detonation, then who did it and why?
Yep.
And they just, you know what?
That's why we didn't go there.
Well, and I get it. And it's just like the Kennedy assassination, you know, for years, no one's going to, I mean, Oswald was the fall guy. You're not going to say it was any other internal organizations that played a part in it. You're not going to say CIA. No one's going to say anything. Well, that's what, 50 years old now? And now we're asking questions. But in the end, what's it going to solve? You know, if we answer the Kennedy assassination, does that change anyone's lives? No, I think there just needs to be an awareness that the information that we get is not always as it seems. And you got to be informed. You got to question the narratives and question the sources. You know, gotcha. Follow the money. Who has the most clues? Questions like that.
Oh, now you're sounding like a conspiracy theorist.
What's that?
Now you're sounding like a conspiracy theorist. Follow the money.
You know what? It's just life. I mean, I'm 65 years old, and I've seen it play out in numerous arenas. Follow the money, and you'll get a lot of answers.
Yeah. Gail, I think we have
one more question. All right. Excuse me. This is from Jean. Sorry, guys. What action is Captain Angulo going to take next, or how is he going to grow from this?
How am I going to grow? Again, I'm going to proceed very cautiously. I want to do more research. In fact, I just picked up a book by your mentor, Richard, The Mysterious Collapse of Building 7. I was thumbing
David
through
Ray
that.
Griffin.
Yeah, it's a very good, it looks like it's going to be a good book. What is the action I'm going to take? I think, first of all, this is not going to become my crusade. I'm sorry. It's just not. There's too many angles to go down. But as an author of a book, I want to make sure that I am providing the best truthful information, because most of all, if I'm telling you in writing, here are the procedures to go into a burning building, I need your trust. You know, I can't violate the trust of the public. I have to write truthful stuff. But what am I going to do? Get that balance just right. How is that with the camera? There we go. This is really the problem. This is now a standard. This is kind of like the Bible chapter and verse. And I am going to bring up this subject, the NIST versus the NFPA 1700, to some of the people that are asking for feedback on it. Again, this is a new publication, 2021. So one of the people I know on the committee is asking for my feedback. I'm going to give it to him. And I will mention specifically, I said that I think we either have to address the NIST report on Building 7 or distance ourselves from it. But to not mention the possibility of fire-induced progressive collapse, you know, you're closing your eyes to this. And we need to be able to trust NFPA and the standards.
And you're putting lives at risk if they close their eyes.
That's what it's all about. I mean, it's probably in their mission statement. I don't have it in front of them, but I'm sure the NFPA has a mission statement that has something to do with the safety of firefighter and protecting civilian lives. So, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pose this question, which encompasses our whole dialogue for the last almost 2 hours, and pose that to the NFPA committee.
There we go.
It's probably about as far as I'm willing to take it right now.
Oh, I hear you. A great place to let it go. Any final comments other than that? And can people locate you or your work? Or would you prefer to refer them to Papa website?
You can. I just put a plug for my book if you're really interested in what I have to say on the high-rise firefighting. You can get Engine Company Fire Ground Operations 4th edition by going to jonesandbartlettlearning.com. It's also available on amazon.com, I know.
And chapter 15 is on high rise, right? Of this
is it 15? I have to look. I think it is. I'll tell you right now. I have it right here.
I just happen to have a copy.
Chapter 15. Yeah, chapter 15 is on high rise.
So, if you want to know how firefighters deal with high rises with burning fires in them, and dealing with the public, the tenants of the building. Be sure to check that out. Well, Captain Raul Angulo, I am so grateful for you coming onto the show today and explaining all this and sharing with people how successful we were in Boston at the National Fire Prevention Association convention last week. I thought it was incredible. We're going to have Eric Lawyer, firefighter, who was also there and the founder of Protecting All Protectors Alliance. So this is going to be an incredible conversation. Stand by for that one. Thanks again, Captain Angulo. We'll catch up with you again.
All right, Richard and Gail, thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Gail, thank you so much. We appreciate your wonderful presence and hard work also. And that will do it for us.
Thank you for joining us on yet another informative and soul-stirring episode of Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. We'll be on the air again next week with another very special guest in the 9/11 Truth Movement and beyond. Visit us at richardgage911.org, where you can find our schedule, learn about the WTC evidence, and of course, sign up for our emails and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.